Good evening again. I'm trying to break myself of saying okay is the very first word, so we'll see how long it lasts. So we had a couple of questions in the break that are probably germane to many of you. One of them was, I talked about taking the fact that let me get a fresh piece here, that you needed to do some conversion for quoted characters, and that is true. That is, if you look at the definition of a character literal, it expects not four characters, but a single character that this guy denotes. So that means you've got to do a tad of processing, strip off the outer single quotes, check to see if you have a backslash or not. If you have a backslash, the next character tells you what to cue on, namely new line or tab or backslash or tick symbol. Or if it's not a backslash, then the characters itself. Fortunately, you do not have to do that for quoted strings, which are nastier still. So, oddly enough, and I'll explain why, if you have that, all you do is return the string literal, but you now return all five characters. And you say to yourself, why? Obviously, those double quotes at a minimum have to be stripped off. And the answer is yes, but not by you. What happens is, as we generate code at the final stage, we're going to take strings and pass them to the generated code that the Jasmine assembler will process. And it wants strings in quoted form because Jasmine allows people to write that code as well as generate it through a compiler. So if I had this string, for example, this eventually would be pasted into generated code by Jasmine in quoted form, and it will do the stripping of the quotes and the conversion of backslash n into a new line. So I could have you convert to internal form and then convert back. But that's kind of like wasted effort, and I really don't see the point of it. So you do a little bit of that on characters just to get a sense of what's going on. But for quoted strings, you don't need to do it. Just pass the string entirely in its literal form, and later on Jasmine will do the work for us. So continuing on, we're talking about errors. What we found out is for many errors, it's simply the case that the very first character that's erroneous will cause a scanner error. That means we'll go down all our valid definitions, nothing will match. We'll get down to this final last case thing that was the single dot and some kind of code that will print out error message, system.out.println, error, character, illegal character ignored, or something like that. Phrase it as you find appropriate. And that will oftentimes be enough. But be careful, because there's no way for you to tell the parser, which is the next stage, that you found an illegal token. There is, at the parser's level, no definition of an illegal token. And after all, even if there were, what the heck does it do? Oh, it's a legal token. What? How does that help me? So it was garbage. Garbage in, garbage out is usually what happens. So we throw the thing away. And that being the case, it may be that the remainder of the program will generate somewhat bogus errors. It's unavoidable, doesn't happen too often, but it may happen. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One here, suppose I was typing Fortnite, what, by the way, is a Fortnite? That's something you don't hear in the States very often, unless you're studying Shakespeare or something. 2 weeks, 14 nights, I guess, Fortnite. That's kind of a cool word. I don't know why it fell into disuse, but lots of other words which are less pleasant have come into use, so that's, I guess, the way of life. So if we meant to type Fortnite and just accidentally hit the dollar sign key, as sometimes do, and got an extra character, fed this into our compiler, and particularly to our scanner, if the dollar sign hadn't been there, Fortnite would be scanned probably as an identifier. And it might make sense. You know, Fortnite is, what did I do for the last 2 weeks or whatever? But because of the scan error, four is going to stop there. Remember, dollar sign can't be part of an identifier or a reserved word. So it'll go ahead and return four. In our language, four is not reserved, but in richer languages, it is. So it's entirely possible in a super version of CSX, Java, or some Java variant, this would be returned as four, the return reserved word four. We print out an error message, dollar sign, illegal, ignored. The user would see it. But, of course, the parser doesn't know this error occurred. You saw something invalid, print an error message, and threw it away. And then you'd resume with tonight, I guess, and that'd be an identifier. So the parser would get this, and that would probably cause a secondary error saying, hey, I have a syntax error because many languages require a paren after the four to have the various components that control the four. So assuming your language is designed that way, it would say this identifier is illegal, give you a syntax error. So it is sometimes the case that a scanning error can cause a parser error. A parser error can sometimes cause later on errors in type checking or code generation or all the rest. I wish there was an easy way to fix that. There's not. I mean, one thing we could do is the first time you saw something as trivial as a bad character, you stop the compile. But that seems overly rigid in the sense that in many cases, the rest of the program will be valid or almost valid, and you can get valuable information by scanning and parsing the remainder of the program. So my recommendation in this case is give the scanner error. Most users know if you get error messages you can't understand, fix the ones you can't understand, cross your fingers, say a silent prayer, is prayer allowed here or not, I guess, the situation. So say it quietly and nobody will notice, and maybe all the errors will go away. So I just wanted to warn you about that, but there are other errors that are so major at the token level that we want to have a special way of handling them. That is, they're still errors. We may or may not be able to fix them. I'll talk about that in a moment. But at very minimum, we want to give not just the error message that I showed you at the beginning of class, where I said double quote was bad, and then I said each of the characters inside the string was bad because they couldn't be placed in context once the double quote was ignored. I want to give an error message that says something very specific, particularly in the case of a quoted string trying to cross a line boundary. I want to say, hey, at this line, you had a string that tried to cross a line boundary. That's not allowed. In fact, question comes up here. What do I do having found that out? Notice I'm almost at the point if I know what's wrong. Most users say, stupid compiler, if you know what's wrong, why don't you fix it and quit bothering me? But here's the problem with this, and it's got a nice analogy. Right now, we're kind of in the dull season if you're a sports fan. American football is over. Baseball is not started yet. We have one of the rare years where the Badgers are actually a good team, and that's worth watching. I've never been much of an NBA fan, so I don't watch that. So I get so desperate that I overwatch it. On Saturday mornings, you can watch round football coming from Europe. The Premiership, if you follow English football, or they have the Champions League for all of Europe. And if you like that sport, I mean, it really can be very exciting if you savor a 0-0 draw where somebody almost scored or something like that. But it turns out one of the more exciting plays in round ball football, a.k.a. soccer, is a penalty shot. And a penalty shot is a situation, of course, you know what it is, but modern keepers, what does a keeper do when he knows that he's going to have to face up a penalty shot? Did you just stand there and hope the guy taking the penalty shot shoots it right at him? No. So what does the keeper do? Keeper makes a guess, doesn't it? And what does the keeper do? Typically jumps to the left or jumps to the right from center, hoping that with a 50-50 chance, you hope, that the person taking the penalty shoots it in your direction and you make a fantastic save. If that doesn't happen, you look like the biggest fool in the world because you jumped left and the keeper jumped right. In fact, an old star of football, the team I follow in the Premiership is Arsenal, and they used to have a really superstar named Thierry Henry, a Frenchman who played for Arsenal. And this guy used to love making goalkeepers look foolish. So one time he had a penalty, he comes running up like he's going to shoot like crazy, and shoots and kicks his leg but doesn't touch the ball. Immediately, the goalkeeper jumps in one direction, and what Henri does is just tap it ever so slowly in the other direction. Now, if this were baseball, Henri would have had a baseball on the side of his in one of his ears next time he was up at the plate. But in this case, the keeper just looked like the biggest fool in the world because it kind of dribbled along in the wrong direction for him, the right direction for the keeper, for the person taking the penalty, and he scored. So what does this have to do with anything else? Notice we can do a similar sort of thing where we guess, and we might guess right and we might guess wrong, when, for example, we find something specific enough that we say, hey, I know exactly what went wrong. Namely, you see something like this, and maybe something like this is following. So you say to yourself, oh, I know what went wrong here. It's a situation there where there was a missing close quote. Oh, I know, up again, sorry. Somebody has to bring an air horn or something. You know, I'll learn. So what's happening is you've got enough information to say this guy is bogus. And that's all I'm asking for you to do. But notice if you risky enough, you could say to yourself, there was a missing double quote here. I could insert that. This is like the goalkeeper jumping in one direction and hoping that this did not follow. Because if this did follow, notice what's going to happen there is this was not a string by itself. This should have been part of its body. The alternative is to throw this all away. I'm sorry, throw this all away or try to resume scanning in the body of a double quote. But that may or may not be there. So it turns out there's a temptation, even if you know quite specifically what happened. Namely, there was a new line in that double quote that probably means there's a remainder of a string there. You could try to go ahead and do that, but you don't know that for a fact. It may be the situation you haven't scanned this far yet, so you don't know what those characters are. We can see them as humans who have the big picture, but not there. So it's tempting, but something that's a little bit risky, like goalkeeper jumping left or right, to say, okay, this is, in this case, this is not a missing double quote here. There's a double quote there, and go ahead and continue scanning. One way to do that would be to simply go ahead and scan this whole thing and throw away the new lines that were in there. Say, bad programmer, bad, bad. And if you have children or small animals or something, they get into something and you have to take it away from them and tell them, you know, not to go chewing on it. I can't tell you when I had a couple of kittens. Max had these really cool little power supplies with the tiniest little cord you ever might imagine. And it turns out these cords were excellent chewing material for kittens who were just getting their teeth. So I went through, I think, at least three power supplies, and these are totally unfixable. The little guy chews through enough of it, shorts it out, and it's dead. And what do power supplies cost in Apple? 50, 60 bucks? 80. Yeah, it sounds like the price has gone up. Fortunately, they're past the chewing stage now, so I don't have to worry about that. But so at any rate, in this particular case, what I'm going to show you is a way to do the minimum, namely give a good solid error message saying, if I went and did my standard error handling, what would happen in this particular case is this line that I've circled would be rejected, just as I showed you at the beginning of class. And because it's rejected, the double quote will be ignored. That's bad, because you're usually not going to know why the double quote's being ignored. And then the hi mom may be scanned as identifiers. You know for sure that means Mr. Parser later on is going to give you other error messages. And then you see the exclamation point, the shriek. That's probably going to be ignored and get an error, not ignored, but get an error message. And then you continue on, the ampersand and all the rest, and you get all sorts of insanity. So just a warning on that, what I want you to do is, for special cases, and I'll show you the technology of it, you can create these special error tokens. This is a misnomer because these are not tokens that are returned to the parser. These are defined as if they were tokens, but they don't return to the parser. They rather give error message. So error message tokens might be a better name, but it's a little less convenient to spell out. So these will be used particularly in cases where the ordinary character-by-character message doesn't work. And let me show you a couple of those. The first one is essentially a variant, a slightly simpler variant of what I've just been talking about. Namely, if I use this particular definition, and this is pretty close to what you're actually using, I'm not talking about the rest of the unprintables, but I'm saying you may not, in a quoted string, have a double quote, an end-of-line character, or a backslash. You may have an escaped double quote, and you may have an escaped backslash. So that's a slightly simpler version of this. But again, this is going to have exactly the problem I showed you earlier. If I feed this guy something with an end-of-line in it, notice it's not going to be able to eat the end-of-line because I specifically say you may not have an end-of-line by this part, and neither of these match an end-of-line. Therefore, it'll be rejected. I'll stop at the end of the line, can't scan any further, go back to the very first character, say it was illegal, try to resume scanning, and again, try to scan the body of the string as if they were valid tokens, and that's a disaster. So my alternative is to let this coexist with this definition. This guy above will return valid quoted string tokens. This guy is exactly the same, except it allows the end-of-line character as a terminator. This will never happen in a valid token because a valid token would be the situation there before you got to the end of line, you get the matching double quote, and away you go. So in this particular case, this guy will match a double quote, string prefix, end of line, and say, okay, I found what looks like a token. But it won't be returned by a token unless you want to do this sort of guessing, like a keeper. You could insert the double quote and say, I think this is a string by itself where the user merely forgot to put the double quote in there. I'm not quite sure that's the best guess, but you could try it. It might work sometimes, wouldn't work all the time. But here you can simply give an error message that's nice and specific. Now you say, error, illegal quoted string, quoted strings may not cross line boundaries. And it's then up to the user to fix the problem whichever way he or she wants. But you gave a good, honest message that's far more informative than what we previously showed. So as I was saying here, you could try to repair it. That's kind of iffy. You may guess right, you may guess wrong. Either way, it's not going to be perfect. But giving a good error message at a minimum is enough to get the problem fixed, you would hope. We have a similar problem in languages like C, C++, and Java that have multi-line comments. In fact, if anything, those are worse. Imagine this sort of situation, and I'll move the paper up first. Say we're in C or Java that have the /*/ form. And right here, I was starting to write down */, and I wrote down, let's see, where's ** on my keyboard? Something like that. I meant to hit a /, and I got a comma, for example. In this sort of situation, it's terminated. What would you imagine a scanner that could handle /*/ comments properly do? This thing is even worse than the thing about the string crossing a line boundary. Why? Well, it's going to turn out in this particular case, this is all going to be one comment, starting here and ending there. And what the net effect's going to be is that this assignment statement, which looks like it ought to be compiled, is going to be missing. Remember, when something is a comment, it's thrown away. And oftentimes, when you throw away part of a program, the compiler's not going to know that you threw it away. It's simply that line wasn't there. So this line here will never even be recognized. This is a runaway comment. You may have heard of those, a comment that ate Cleveland situation. And how can we possibly handle this? This is sort of a lexical error, but maybe, just maybe, the user meant it. I very much doubt it. But it's one of these cases where we're going to want to work on this particular problem bit by bit. Now, it turns out that the sort of comment we have with the double pound sign is not quite as sensitive in one way, more sensitive in another, because the openers and the closers are identical. So let's see how we would handle something like this. So I'm going to do this out of the programming language Pascal, which had a simpler form of comment. This is only to keep these definitions readable. So in this case, in their language, they had a curly brace open and a curly brace close were comment delimiters. That's kind of nice if that were still available, but the problem is all the nice matching symbols have been stolen by modern programming languages. Parens are obviously used. Square brackets are used. Braces, you know, these curly guys are used. Are there any other pairs of matching symbols? Less than and greater than are used, of course, in mathematics. So that's they could match. Some languages actually have something like this and that. But, of course, that's the shift operator in C and C++, and it's used extensively in I/O, for better or worse, in C++. So you kind of run out of them. So let's go back to this just because it's easy to understand. So what happens is, for defining comments in Pascal, it's really easy. We say a comment begins with a left brace, ends with a right brace, and the body is anything you want other than a right brace. So very simple definition, but notice it's going to fall prey to the sort of error I showed a bit ago. What might happen in some situations is that we have a very last comment with something missing. And it turns out this is the last comment we have, and finally we hit end the file. This is something that would also be a problem, namely, in this particular case, it would look for a closing right brace and never find it. What happened here is somebody meant to type a right brace and they typed something else. Where's right brace? Yeah, it might be something like, they meant to type a right brace and a right bracket is right on the same keyboard. Yeah. Oh, son of a gun. Come on, guys. Okay, thank you. So in this particular case, we want to solve this problem, and then we'll handle the other. The issue on this one is this is an honest gosh valid error, but it's going to have exactly the same sort of problem the unmatched string had. Namely, if I have a comment that opens, and in this particular case, I don't have a closer, it's going to be a situation here where the rest of this program is going to be eaten, and then it's going to be rejected character by character. That's not so good. So one way to handle that, if I could have an end the file character, is I would use that. But of course, we don't have an end the file character, and we'll get to a way to get around that in a bit. Remember, I warned you that having an end the file character might be handy. This would say, if I had this particular situation, I'm going to give an error token definition that would say, hey, starting at this line and that column, you had a comment that wasn't properly closed. And we know it wasn't properly closed because we never saw a right brace and we hit end the file. So it's really saying fix this comment because the rest of the program after the comment can't really be properly scanned until we know how that comment had to be closed. So that's one thing we can handle pretty easily. Another situation is what happens if we have what's shown here. And this is the thing I mentioned a bit ago with slash star, and now I'm just using braces. The trouble here, this is a valid token, which almost certainly is wrong. The problem is that from this brace up to that brace, everything's eaten as a comment, including everything between what probably were meant to be two separate comments. So we want to have some way of handling that, and again, we can use error tokens to handle that. So now it's a situation there where we're going to break legal comments down into two pieces. A legal comment that does not have an open brace inside its body, which is far and away the more common, is going to be defined this way. So this will match a large subset of valid comments and not give any kind of message, because there's nothing all wrong. It says, I open with an open brace. My body is anything other than an open brace or a closed brace. And finally, I am closed by a valid closed brace. So in this case, I have no open braces in the body and therefore no reason to give a warning. This sort of situation, and this is much nastier. This is one of those cases where the definition has to be read carefully to understand what's going on. So my experience is, in a lot of cases, it's really good to read regular expressions from the outside in rather than the inside out. Usually when you see a complex formula, you read from the inside, seeing the fundamental pieces and then how they build together. So this guy is saying, I want to see an open brace and a closed brace. And what happens is, I'm going to have good stuff here that is not a brace and therefore is not controversial. So anything that's not a left or right brace. And over here, I'm going to have something that's not a left or a right brace. But guess what? I'm going to have one or more open braces in the middle. And those are the things that give me worry, because now I have at least one open brace with non-brace stuff around it. And I don't know how many of those I'm going to have, so I'm going to put a plus around there. So it says, in this particular definition, you're going to have at least one unmatched left brace with stuff around it, and maybe you'll have additional left braces. The more you see, probably the worse off you are. And what this thing would then do is give an error message that says, error, in the comment beginning here and ending there, I saw one or more open braces. This is a possible mismatched comment error, and please be aware of it. So this would be a warning. It is legal, but it's probably not what people want. Oh, in fact, apropos to this, in this comment and all the rest, as we read multi-line comments, be they in this form or the form we have, one of the things you have to do is figure out how line numbers and column numbers change. If you match multi-line comment, how do you do that? So it could be the pound sign ones we have, or the brace ones, or slash, star, star, slash. It's much the same flavor. You've matched something that's multi-line, and it's scanned as one unit. It's thrown away because it's a comment, but it surely changes the line number and column number associated with remaining symbols. So how do you go about figuring out what the line number and column numbers are? Well, you have a method called YYText, which will give you the text of what you've just scanned. And if you look at the string library, there's a very rich library of all kinds of string functions. The easiest way, though, is simply to write a little bit of code that shoots through that comment, character by character, saying, are you a new line? A character is a new line. You can ask, are you equal / n, the new line character. If you are, the line number increases by one, and the column number resets to one. See another, you see another. Finally, when you see the last new line in the comment, you got the correct line number, and then you have to read how many characters were in that prefix at the very end, or suffix, I guess it is, to adjust the column number properly. Now, easiest way to visualize it is writing a loop, but I believe there are methods inside the Java String class that will make things simpler. I'd have to double check, but I think there's one at least that counts how many times a given character occurs in a string. If that's true, you could say, how many new line characters do I have? That's how many times I increase the line number counter. And then you have to find the last new line and count the characters in the suffix. And that's how to do that. So it's a little bit of honest gosh programming, but you know, sometimes you got to do the work if nobody else will. So that's an example here. So what this has to say is, now you don't really quite have this problem in our language, so don't worry as much about this in our language, because if we had something like this, where this was meant to be two comments and I missed the second pound sign, how is this going to be scanned by the normal regular expression pattern? This will start, this will simply be something in the body of the comment, and this will be the closer. So it'll scan from there up to there, and then it's going to mess up the remainder of the comment. There's not a heck of a lot you can do because comments are meant to cross line boundaries anyway. So knowing that this was probably meant to be a closed comment and this was not meant to be the closed comment is kind of difficult. That's why in most languages, the comment opener and the comment closer are different pairs. So you can at least tell what's an opener and what's a closer. So the stuff I showed about braces or /*/ is more applicable when the comment opener and the comment closer are different symbols. But I thought I still wanted to talk about that. And we do have one remaining situation. What happens if we have a single line comment, //, that's not terminated by end of line? That is, rather than having end of line, you have an end of file. But by the way, I used to think that was such an odd combination, it would never ever happen. And I was holding office hours yesterday, and guess what happened? I did a little cut and pasting, and for some reason, when I cut and pasted a little bit of code, I got a line up to, but not including an end of line. So it turned out my final line did not have an end of line, and of course it screwed things up. And the only way I found out about it was the very last line did not have a line number in the display associated with it. Because I think what the line number does is actually count the number of new lines or end of lines that it sees in the file. So that gave me a warning. I went in there and put the end of line in there and everything got fixed. So a situation where you actually have something where a final line is not terminated properly by an end of line character can occur. The question is, that's when we can throw at you. We can't throw at you the double pound sign business because openers and closers look alike. But if I throw this at you, here's a case where you say, oh, I know what I want. I want the line terminated by end of file, not end of line. But there is no end of file marker. So how do you handle that? And surprisingly, the way you handle it is by putting something that looks like it should not be correct, but it is. I write this down as an error token. How does this? This looks exactly like what we did previously, except we had a new line there. So it's exactly this definition, but the new line was missing, so I put a definition that doesn't have it. Well, wait a minute. How can that possibly work? And the way it works is, if I have valid comments, this guy is going to match too, But guess what? It's going to be one character shorter than the other definition. So if I take this one versus and have these two competing, for all valid single line comments, except the one that isn't properly terminated at the end of a file, let me put, this is the valid one and this is the error one. So this one will normally work for all valid single line comments, except if I happen to terminate without an end of line at the very one, and then this one will match, but okay. And in this particular case, you can do one of two things. You could put an error message in there, or you could simply match and say, what the heck, it doesn't really matter because it's a comment, and let it go. You can take your taste on that one. I'm not sure which is the better one to do. It's such a piddling little thing to complain about, but it is, in fact, you know, the comment was not terminated by end of line. One way to say it would be simply that all comments are not terminated by end of line, but match up to but not including end of line, and then the end of line, if there, is consumed as white space. Excuse me. And that would work too. But I just wanted to warn you about that because it's kind of odd that this particular pattern, which looks incomplete, actually works properly given that you have the longest match rule to back you up. So something that's slightly shorter because a vital character is missing will work. And again, you can just put it in there as an extension of the single line comment definition, or you can consider it an error token and print an error message. It's again, if you're one of these guys that likes to complain about everything, or you're one of these easygoing guys that say, it's not worth worrying about, I know what you mean, and let's go on. So any questions on that? Okay, let me go back. As long as it accepted everything except new line, right? Yeah, not bad. Yeah, but then I wouldn't have anything to talk about right now. Sometimes you got to make a mistake just to look foolish to see what the better way of doing things are. And it's partially, it's how it puts you in your mind. I mean, a lot of cases, programming languages and definitions are not what's mathematically optimal, but what seems normal to a person designing it. I think of a single line comment as matching everything up to the end of line. But then letting the end of line character go and letting it grab his white space seems kind of, but that's just me. And you can actually do it the other way. I'm in a situation, you can refine your definition. We'll probably never notice it. And if the TA notices it, you can get an exemption from me of redefining yours, saying it's anything that doesn't include an end of line character, but not the end of line character. That handles this extra case nicely. And the end of line character will, in fact, be eaten as white space. So in this case, it matches two tokens rather than one, but who cares? It's a minor enough difference. And that perhaps is the better way of doing it. But I love having something to talk about in this context, just to say the alternatives. All right, so sometimes you got to do the wrong way to do it the right way. No, I mean, it's true. Sometimes, what do they say? You know, for every hard problem has a simple solution, and it's usually wrong. So it's a situation here. In many cases, something looks like it's simpler. In this case, it is as good a solution, maybe better. I'll consider them roughly equal, but it does have the advantage of handling this unexpected case better. Good deal. Other questions? How are we doing on time here? I think we're okay. Yeah, we're fine. So what I want to do now is change hats semi-completely. What does semi-completely mean? I don't know. What we're going to stop talking about now is how to build scanners, how to handle errors, and we're going to get down as scientists, computer scientists, to how these things run. In a sense, if I was just doing a trade school type thing, we could drop this whole section. We just say, they work by magic. There's some brilliant computer scientist who's way smarter than you'll ever be, who invented these years ago, decades ago, centuries ago. And that individual was way beyond what we could ever understand, and he or she or both of them went and solved it. But it really turns out that there's some very nice theory here that answers this question. And the question is, how do we take regular expressions, which are patterns, and convert them into something that I can implement and implement efficiently. Remember, I made this boast earlier that I could have 50, 100, 1,000 different token definitions, and the number of definitions was irrelevant when I scanned. What's relevant with respect to the speed was how many characters I read. And the more I read, obviously, the longer it's going to take, if only because I have to advance a little further to decide whether this is valid or not. It's not obvious that it would work that way. And in fact, if you were asked to implement a scanner, one way to do it, that be an inferior way, would be to do, let's try the first pattern. Did it work? Nope. Let's try the second and actually implement them as a series of if statements. If you're token number one, you should have this pattern. If you're token two, you should be this pattern, and on and on and on, which would be slower as you added tokens. And you have all the problems of, did I have the token matching in the right order, et cetera? Did I match, for example, a single equal before I tried to match a double equal and therefore misinterpret a double equal as two single equal tokens, things like that. So it'd be a nasty thing to do, and it's kind of nice to see how the theory bails us out. So we're going to actually see how something like JLEX builds a scanner logic. We're not going to worry about the detail of buffering and where do I store the characters and if I match a character, how do I remember whether it's consumed or not. That's all bookkeeping. It's important, but it's also routine. So what we're going to do is a multi-step translation. So we're going to start out with regular expressions. And the first thing I want to mention is as you write down regular expression rules, you're really writing down not 10 or 50 or 100 regular expression rules. Believe it or not, you're actually writing down one in a more convenient form. So if, for example, I had a definition that said if, and I had a token for that, and a token for identifiers, pattern like that, with a second definition, it looks like I have two regular expressions. Okay. Looks like I have, I got to use that monitor there. So it looks like I have two regular expressions, but actually when it turns out that the scanner gets built, what happens is each of these definitions gets an implicit OR bar. And it's saying what you really want here is I want to have this token or that one or that one. And since it's implicitly each definition is an alternative, they don't make you put the OR bar in there. But from the theory, I'm going to start showing you, if I have a series of token definitions, all we're going to do is figure out how to match that particular token and that one and put an OR bar between them and show you how two tokens with an OR are handled in terms of generating a scanner for the one or the other. So be aware of that, and we're really doing a little bit more than we realized in our token definition. So what we're going to do is we're going to go from a regular expression, and we're going to translate in a couple of steps. The first step will be something that is easier to understand, but not so easy to scan with, and that's called a non-deterministic. Finite automaton, which I'll abbreviate FA. And I'll talk about what that is in a moment, but it turns out the reason we do this is because there's a very simple mapping from regular expressions into non-deterministic automata. Now, what does non-deterministic mean? It means something bad when you're programming, namely, I can't predict how it's going to operate. Well, that's pretty bad because I want to know how my program operates to be sure it's operating correctly. So we'll do another translation to a deterministic. And the translation is a fairly clever one. This business I talked about, some smart computer scientist years ago figuring it out. It's something that I don't think is that subtle, but it's something that's not all that obvious and has some insights that I think are very valuable. And we can even go one step further, namely, sometimes those automata come out bigger than we want. And if you were going ahead and using JLEX, you may have noticed that at the end of the listing, they do an optimization phase. Seems like an odd thing to do, but we can actually take an automata that's large and in some cases make an equivalent one that's much smaller. The advantage is it's easier to understand if we want to, and it uses less space because small is better than big in the context of putting something in a computer memory. So we can also optimize this if we want. So we can have an optimized finite automaton. And what I'll be doing for the rest of tonight's lecture and maybe into the next one, depending on how fast I talk or how long you can stay awake, we're going to go through those steps. So I talked about this non-deterministic automaton, this one right here. And I said that's bad because it's not easy to program. The two ways that you can have an automaton that's hard to program is by having a non-deterministic or non-unique path in the automaton. Remember, our idea was we read character by character going from one state to another. But what happens if we have two paths that begin with the same letter? And here's an example of that. I don't know which one to follow. And what's unfortunate is this can happen all the time. If I had two reserved words, for example, that begin with the same letter, like if and in, if I see an I, am I in the one automaton to recognize an if, or am I in the other automaton to recognize an in? Don't know. And this is the sort of pattern I would create when I was first translating from regular expressions to finite automata. There's also something else that is handy to define with, but difficult to program, and that's lambda. Remember, lambda is this empty sequence. It's an option you had but chose not to use. The trouble with lambda is it isn't matching anything. It's the non-match, in effect. So how do you program the effect of not doing anything? And yet, actually, we have to. So let's see what that means. Here's a case where we have two paths. One is labeled by A. That's pretty easy. The other is labeled by lambda. So what all does that mean? It means that without reading anything, as a free pass, you can go from this state to that state without matching anything, if you care to. So it says you had the option of going to that state if you want to use it. But if I have that option once, I may have it several times. And the question is then, how do I take care of all the spots where I have this option? So what we're going to do is we're going to originally create automata that have non-unique transitions, different paths, same letter, or some that have lambdas intermixed. But later on, we'll find a way to root those things out and get rid of them and have an equivalent automaton that never tries to match a lambda, because they don't exist anymore, and always has a unique path for any given character. And that actually is the automaton that we program when we generate a scanner using something like JLEX. So as I said a bit ago, what we're going to do is a two-step process. The first process will be fairly easy, and it's kind of reminiscent of something that you may have done in elementary or high school if you were taking a physics lab or a circuits lab or an electricity lab. And that is build a device bit by taking together predefined components and adding them together. Back when I was in school, we had situations where you could build an electromagnet, for example. You'd have a power supply, and you'd have a piece of iron with coiled wire around it, and you turn on the power, and of course it would pick up some heavy piece of metal, and you try to get your friend to put his or her hand right underneath it and pull a switch, and of course the magnet would stop being a magnet, and whoosh, thing goes down, and see what you could drop on somebody's hand. And lots of other alternatives like that. You could have a little light bulb you could switch on and off. Later on, people had things where you could actually do things like do computer circuits by taking AND gates and OR gates and putting them together and getting some logic device. So if you knew how to do ANDing and ORing, you could, for example, do something that did some primitive adding. Those classes were actually after I went to school, but now they're very common, and you may have had that. Turns out, oddly enough, we're going to do something very similar by going from finite automata, from regular expressions to finite automata. So the way we're going to do that is by creating tiny little devices that match trivial things. And let's go ahead and look at the most trivial. And they are individual characters, lambda, and a sequence of characters known in advance. So if, for example, I say, give me an automaton that matches A, you go into your little box of predefined circuits and say, here's an automaton that does it. It's a start state, it reads an A, and it's all done. Well, what about AB? Then we'll simply have a sequence. A, that's an A, followed by B, and we're all done. What about lambda? Well, we'll do a start state, and lambda says I can jump from the start state to the final state for free. So essentially, it's equivalent of ending in the final state at the start. So individual items like lambda or characters or a string of characters can be pre-programmed into trivial automata. Okay, so what's the hard part? The hard part, as we'll see, is putting them together into composite automata. So if I know how to create an automaton for one term like this, and I do, and I know how to do an automaton for a second example, this one, and these little boxes represent pre-programmed components. That I already know how to build. How can I build one that does an OR? Remember, that's the thing I said we do implicitly at the beginning. And the answer is I take these two components that are pre-programmed, and I create a new start state with lambdas. Remember, lambdas say I don't have to match anything, so it means I can go to the top or the bottom. And I take the final states at the end and have a lambda that goes to a new final state, and I make these two previous final states non-final. So what that's saying, remember, this is still non-deterministic. It's not clear how we'll be able to program it, but it is clear, should be, that this works in matching. So this says, this is something that'll match A, B, or A. How do I know that? Well, the top guy will match an A, B. Lambda, A, B, lambda. That's the same thing as A, B. It gets me to a final state. How about A? Take the bottom path. Lambda, A, and final state. Clearly, this works for extra terms, too. If I have three or four or five, I simply have more boxes and pass to each of them. So if I know how to build a circuit for individual regular expressions, I can also do it for the OR of those expressions. Let's do concatenation. And in concatenation, it says if I know how to do a circuit for A and a circuit for B, I can go ahead and do a match for A followed by B. How do I do that? Well, here's the automaton for A. Here's the automaton for B. And I simply wire them together. If you ever did a circuits lab, this is like putting a couple of resistors in sequence, or maybe yeah, you put a light bulb and a resistor in sequence, and you see the light bulb gets dimmer because the resistor is eating up some of the voltage from the battery. So in this particular case, it says I can match all of A, but instead of stopping, immediately start matching B, go through it, and then I'll be done. So ORs and concatenation or sequencing can be handled. The final one is less obvious. That's the iteration, and there are a couple of ways of doing that, but I'll just do the one shown here. Namely, suppose I know how to match a circuit for A, and I want to do A star. Remember, A star says match something in A once, I'm sorry, zero, or once, or twice, or as many times as you want. So I'll start with a new start state out here, that one of the things it can do is go to a final state immediately with lambda. That says I don't have to match anything. I can go to the final state and stop. So it has a choice of matching nothing at all. Or I can shoot through the circuit for A, matching A, get to a final state. Or I can go back for another iteration by reading lambda and going back to the start state for A. So notice the effect of this is go through this A box zero times, once, twice, and so on. And those are the three fundamental components. We can also do plus. That's not much different. Oh, there. So not much different there. So let's go ahead and take an example of this before we go on and do the conversion. So let's go ahead and do something where we have all three varieties. So let's say I have A followed by B or C. star. And again, that's something starting to look a little bit more realistic. This is not too far from some of the patterns we have. So it says, I want to have an automaton that matches exactly that. So we're going to write it down and see that it actually works as expected. So the first rule is, generate something that matches A. And I won't make that final yet because it's only incomplete. So it says the only way to start out is matching A. What I can then do is match a B. Or a C. So notice if I want to match A followed by B or C just once, I can go through the A, take the top half, lambda B, which is the same as AB, A, empty string, match the C, match that. But now I have a star here. So remember, the star says I could go to a final state without matching anything, or I could go through the automaton once. Notice now it'll go A, B, lambda, final, A, C, lambda, final. Or I can go back and iterate again, go back to this state which anticipated a B or a C. And I'll show you later how to clean this up. Remember, the lambdas are going to disappear. So this is just to say, yeah, that circuit works. It would do exactly what this automaton did. And I can make them bigger and bigger. I can handle all sorts of things like knots and so on also. We'll talk about that in a bit. But the notion so far is I can build something that looks like an automaton out of any regular expression. The hard part here is getting rid of these lambdas and getting rid of the non-determinism when I have something like the A, B, or A. Because now I don't know whether to take the top path or the bottom path. So what we're going to have to do is come up with some brilliant idea. And a good way to do that is be motivated by television. They have all sorts of good motivations. Turns out that in a spot in New Jersey, not too far from where The Sopranos was filmed, most of you are familiar with Sopranos, said in its time it was a pretty good television show. It was about, mafiosi, mafia types living in New Jersey. And actually, I had a friend and former student who lived about a half hour. He lived in New Jersey about a half hour from where the Soprano home was supposed to be. And people would always, tourists would always come in and say, where's the Soprano home? Thinking that Tony and the family actually lived there. But anyway, it was not Tony Soprano, but it was perhaps somebody akin to him. And they went to a horse track. Now, of course, none of you have ever been there. You probably never heard of it. So I'm going to get in trouble with Judy for mentioning this. But this is a place where people can legally place bets on a horse race. But what these guys were doing was actually saying, I'm going to buy tickets for every horse in the race. So if there are eight horses running, they buy eight tickets for A, B, C, and all the way down. Now, at first, that sounds like a great idea. Because if I buy tickets for each and every horse, I'm going to win. So why don't I do that? Why don't we do that? We'll go down there and just buy all the possibilities, be guaranteed to win, and make money. What goes wrong on that? Well, what does the odds mean? Explain to me. I'm a novice. I've never actually been there. I just heard the story. That's right. What happens is the payout isn't, if you think about the money you pay, say it's $2 a ticket, and you buy eight, so it's $16. You're not guaranteed the winning horse pays $16. As the man said, of odds, it may be a long shot, get paid way more, but as a favorite, you get paid rather less. So you're not guaranteed to make money. Now, why would these guys be buying tickets for all the horse races? And they do this not once, but they do this time after time after time. And remember, they were Tony Soprano types. What would they possibly be doing? These guys are not stupid. I mean, why would they be losing money? Laundering, yes. Situation. These days, unfortunately, I'm not in crime. I hope you aren't. I mean, situation. Epic does legal type things, I'm sure. Nothing under the table or anything like that. One of the hard parts these days of being a criminal is not making the money, but making use of it. In a lot of cases, criminals are put in jail not for the crimes they do, but because, like Al Capone way, way back, because they can't show where they got the money from. It's not like the old days. It's a situation, you may or may not know this, I guess Epic pays with either checks or direct deposit, right? It's not like the old days where you get paid in cash. But there's many places where you cannot use cash above a certain limit. I believe the limit in the United States is $10,000. That means if you saved up your nickels and dimes and you want to go down to the car dealership and buy a car that costs $10,000 or more, you can't get a shoebox full of money and say 10, 20, 30 and count it all the way up. Equivalently, if you go to a bank with a shoebox full of money and it's more than $10,000, they won't take it without doing some paperwork. The reason for this is, of course, if you have that much money, what are they worried about? That it's illegal money, probably drug money, and they want to get a handle on that. So any significantly large amount of money, and these days $10,000 doesn't buy nearly as much as it used to. You can't buy a really nice car for $10,000. You certainly can't buy a home for $10,000. Probably you take a pretty good vacation that comes close to $10,000, depending on how long it is and how wild you get. So what they were doing is money laundering. They may lose money. In fact, they lose money twice because they get the money and then they have to pay taxes on the money. But they love to do that because now it's clean money. And even though they were losing money, they were making dirty money clean and therefore spendable without Uncle Sam or the IRS hammering them. So sometimes people do silly things. We're going to do a similar thing too with respect to automata. The trouble with the guys in the Soprano gang was they didn't know which horse was going to win. So they bet on them all. We're going to do a similar thing in our transformation, and let me show you what I mean. So let me go ahead and number some states here. So we have an automaton, and I'll just put numbers in the states just so I can tell you what state I'm in. Okay, good. So this is similar to what I showed you before, but with state numbering. So it says there are two paths through this automaton. Remember, this is the one for A, B, or A. But again, I don't know how to follow these paths because here's one. And I don't know, in this particular case, whether to go to two or six. So what's my motivation going to be? I'm going to track all the paths that could possibly be right. So I'm going to say after reading zero characters, I'm in state one or state two or state six. And I'll actually track a set of states rather than a singleton state. And they'll always represent all the possibilities. But remember, if they include all the possibilities, they also include the winner. And that's exactly what I want. I don't care about following some losers. That's just like taking tickets for somebody who didn't win. I throw them away. I made a guess and I guessed wrong. As long as I guess right and get the winner, I'm happy. So initially I'll say, okay, I'm in state one, two, or six. Those are all the states. Okay. I'm in state one, two, or six. Those are all the states I can be in without reading anything. So let's read an A. Where would state one go under an A? Nowhere. He's dead. He's a loser. How about state two? He reading an A would go to three. State six reading an A would go to, that's not labeled very well, it's a seven. So all of a sudden I know after reading an A, I'm in either state three or seven. I don't know which is going to be the winner. If it's an invalid input, nobody's a winner perhaps. Let me finish this. Okay. In fact, I should have included a little bit more in this particular case because seven could also read lambda and he goes to five. What happens now is I can decide to stop. I say, is A by itself a valid token? And the answer is if any one of these states is a final state, and it is, that's a winner. What I figured out by brute force, by trying all paths, is that if I want to read an A, the bottom path will do it for me. But I could continue on and read a B. If I read a B, state three will go to state four, and it by a lambda will go to five. State 7 won't go anywhere. It can't read a B. And state 5 won't go anywhere. It can't read a B. So I'll be in state 4 and 5. And if I'm state 4 and 5, 5's a winner. It says, yeah. But now it's figured out the top path was the way to go. And the way I did it is by following all paths, I had to have the right path. And if, for example, I try to read something that's invalid, like a C, state 4 will say, hey, I don't have a path under C. State 5 will say, I don't have a path under C. I can't read any further. So in this case, ABC would be invalid. So my little buzzer just went off, but that's the insight, and we're going to formalize this. The way we're going to change a non-deterministic automata into deterministic automata is essentially do what the Soprano guys did and bet on everybody. Follow all the paths, and if anyone is a winner, we're guaranteed to find it. But wait a minute, we're going to follow losers too, but it's going to turn out that's not any more expensive. We're just going to add possibilities which may not work out, but by following everything, we'll be guaranteed to find the right path, and we'll find it efficiently. So let's take our final break, and we've got 15 minutes, so about 8 o'clock.